From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Crews searching the wreckage of TWA Flight 800 have found two of the plane's engines. The National Transportation Safety Board calls the discovery extraordinarily important. Meanwhile, the Coast Guard is continuing the search. Rear Admiral Edward Christensen describes today's work.
The USS Grasp will continue her surface-supplied air diving, hard hat diving into our primary search area today, as well as utilizing the remotely operated vehicle to continue the search of that area for victims. We're also sending divers down to do some investigation on how best to perhaps remove some wreckage in order to investigate whether or not there are actually victims trapped or in this wreckage.
And investigators in Washington are continuing to review the two flight data recorders. They're listening to a mystery sound that occurred just before the cockpit voice recorder cut off. Airlines are telling passengers, if you're planning to fly, get to the airport early. New security measures announced by President Clinton yesterday are being implemented. This means no more curbside bag check-ins for overseas flights. More carry-on luggage will be examined and more passengers will be questioned and asked for identification. Officials say tighter security could add an extra 15 to 30 minutes to boarding times. The security steps affect major airlines, but one congressman says commercial commuter flights should have the same protection. Congress has reached agreement on how to move forward with bipartisan health insurance reform. The measure has passed both the House and Senate, but was stalled for 3 months over tax-exempt medical savings accounts. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The House passed the savings accounts, but the Senate rejected them. Senator Ted Kennedy and Representative Bill Archer met for 6 hours hashing out the framework of an MS-8 demonstration project. It will include up to 750,000 policies and will last for 4 years. After that, anyone who has the savings accounts will be allowed to keep them, but Congress would have to act again before MSAs could be extended to others. The agreement clears the way for a House-Senate conference committee to craft a final bill that lawmakers hope to send to the president by the end of next week. It also frees up the minimum wage small business tax bill, which had been held up by Republicans angry over the delay in the health insurance bill. The White House has said the president would sign both measures. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole is meeting former President George Bush in Kennebunkport, Maine. Dole says he talks to Bush now and then. He also says the former president has been very helpful. After the men meet privately, they'll make public remarks on the 6th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Dole sponsored the legislation. Mr. Bush signed it. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 32 points at 54.54. This is NPR. Burundi's new military leader has pledged to restore democracy in the Central African country. Pierre Buyoya was speaking at his first press conference after seizing power yesterday. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Buyoya said restoring democracy could take 12 to 18 months, adding, "We cannot speculate." The Tutsi general insisted yesterday's action was not a classic coup, but a move to stop repeated massacres between majority Hutus and a small but politically dominant Tutsi population. The country's main Hutu rebel group today called his promises contemptible and vowed to step up its violent 3-year-old guerrilla campaign. The Hutu leader of Burundi's largest political party has appealed to the international community to send an intervention force. Western nations continue to condemn the coup. Germany's foreign minister today said his government could not support Buyoya's illegal rise to power even if he shows goodwill. The European Union has suspended development aid to Burundi. I'm Jennifer Ludden reporting.
A British study finds 6 in 10 sudden infant death syndrome cases may be caused by exposure to tobacco smoke before or after birth. Many causes have been suggested for SIDS, as it's called. One major concern has been worry about babies who sleep on their tummies, but the British report is the first indicating such a strong link between SIDS and smoking. The British researchers studied 195 babies who died of SIDS over a 2-year period. Hundreds of Chechens rallied in the capital Grozny today, protesting the war against Chechnya and demanding that Russian troops leave the separatist republic. Police fired into the air to try to stop about 500 people from marching through downtown Grozny. The protesters pushed ahead anyway, shouting, "Russians, go home." Several protesters were beaten during isolated clashes with police, but most of the crowd dispersed peacefully by the end of the afternoon. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, writer Isabel Allende reflects on taking care of her daughter Paula during Paula's long coma before succumbing to a rare blood disease. Allende's memoir, Paula, is now on the paperback bestseller list. Also, we remember writer Jessica Mitford, who died this week at the age of 78. We'll feature an interview in which she discussed researching her best-known work, The American Way of Death, an expose of the funeral industry. And Kevin Whitehead reviews a Lester Young reissue. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's often said that there is nothing worse for a parent than to outlive a child. In 1992, novelist Isabel Allende lost her 28-year-old daughter Paula to a rare blood disease that had left her in a coma for the better part of a year. Allende's memoir, Paula, is about the months she spent caring for her daughter as she lay trapped in the state between the living and the dead. Isabel Allende is one of Latin America's best-known novelists. Her uncle was the Chilean president Salvador Allende, who was assassinated in a 1973 military coup. After the coup, Isabel Allende worked underground in the resistance movement, then fled the country. She now lives in San Francisco. Her novels include The House of the Spirits and Of Love and Shadows. Her memoir, Paula, is now on the paperback bestseller list. I spoke to Allende last year when it first came out. Paula was living with her husband in Madrid when she got sick. Isabel Allende flew to the hospital and eventually took her comatose daughter back to San Francisco. This is a reading from the days Paula was hospitalized in Madrid.
You have no control over your body, Paula. You cannot move yourself, and you suffer violent spasms like electric shocks. In one way, I'm grateful for your state of complete innocence. It would be much worse if you understood how ill you are. By trial and error, I'm learning to care for you. At first, the opening in your throat, the tubes and probes horrified me. But I'm used to them now. I can bathe you and change your bedding without help. I have bought a white dress and nurse's shoes in order to blend in with the staff and avoid explanations. No one has ever heard of porphyria here, and they believe you will never get well. Your daughter is so pretty. Poor child. Pray God to take her quickly. Patients who are still able to speak tell me. The atmosphere in this room is depressing. It reminds me of a place to warehouse the mad. Do you sense what is going on around you, Paula? I don't know whether you hear, whether you see, whether you understand any of the things happening in this madhouse, or even if you know me. You just stare toward your right, your wide eyes and dilated pupils fixed on the window where occasionally a pigeon alights. The doctor's pessimism and the sordidness of the ward are eating holes in my heart.
It's Isabel Allende reading from her new memoir, Paula. Why did you write this book while Paula was in a coma?
Paula had a very rare condition called porphyria, and sometimes patients fall in a coma, but after being in coma for a week or 2 weeks, they recover completely with no consequences. So everybody told me that Paula would recover. I thought that maybe during that time she may have forgotten things. You know, memory sometimes fails when patients have been in coma for some time. And I thought I need to explain to my daughter who she is, where she comes from, who we are, all these people around her bed. So I started a sort of letter for her, and the first sentence of the letter is, "Listen, Paula, I'm going to tell you a story so that when you wake up, you will not be so lost." And then I don't know how or why I started telling her my own life, a sort of memoir. And two stories intertwine in these pages, her, what was happening to her during that year and the story of our life as a family.
When your daughter was in a coma, and the coma lasted, what, about a year?
Yes.
Did you believe that she knew that you were there, even though she wasn't conscious?
I don't know. I don't trust my imagination. Maybe it was just my imagination that sometimes I thought she could relate to me in some ways. But the truth is that I tried to get a yes or a no from her, let's say by pressing her fingers or blinking her eyes. But there was never really any response. I want to believe that when we took her home and she was surrounded by her family and cuddled by all of us, she was aware of the love, but I'm not sure.
What are some of the ways you tried to reach her?
I tried everything. We would talk to her all the time and telling her every moment where she was, what had happened, who we were. We tried through music. I recorded things and would put it with earphones so that she would listen it inside her head. But nothing really worked. And the only way of communication I had with her, really, was through instinct, intuition, and dreams.
When you had a dream, did you believe that those dreams were an omen or something that was giving you a deeper message?
I had a very significant dream when she first fell in coma. I was living in a little hotel near the hospital, 15 blocks away from the hospital, and I woke up in the middle of the night. I was with my mother at that time, and I had this terrible dream in which the voice of my grandmother told me that Paula had drank the potion of death. And I got up, dressed, and ran to the hospital. And the nurse must have seen my distress because she let me in and I could go into intensive care and see that she was still alive. I think that at that moment, Paula died. Her brain died. And her body went on living, but her brain died. And I did not recognize the dream as a premonition. I denied it. I didn't want to believe that it was true.
What about the Catholic Church? Did you have any belief that helped sustain you in Catholicism? You'd left the church many years before. Did you have any of that form of faith
I didn't
left?
Go back. No, I didn't go back, but I saw that faith really helped Paula's husband and my mother. So those people who had faith, who were close to some religion, were stronger than I was. But unfortunately, I do not have that.
Paula herself had remained a Catholic, and she had been in a Catholic spiritual retreat before getting sick, and she was volunteering, I believe, at a Catholic school.
Yes. She was very curious about religion, and she was seeking for God all her life. She shared this with me in many ways. She would talk to me and write to me about this, but somehow I didn't pay much attention at the time.
Did you feel like, well, maybe you should summon up more Catholic feelings out of respect for Paula's Catholicism? You know how you sometimes you want to do what you think is right for the person who's sick, and that doesn't mean you can fake any feelings, but you're not sure if you should be trying to believe things out of respect for them.
I didn't try to believe, but I tried to comfort her with things that Catholics do. For example, there was a priest in the hospital, and I asked him to give her I don't know the word in English. In Spanish, is extrema unción, that you give to the dying.
Extreme unction, yeah.
Yeah, and there was always a cross near her bed, and I tried to do the things that she would have done.
You write in your book that your mother was bargaining with God a lot while your daughter was sick.
Yeah, she was always pleading and bargaining and asking God that she would do this if you could just do this for Paula, or she offering her life instead of Paula's. You know, I did the same thing in other ways. I thought that writing was like some magic thing that could keep her alive, and as long as I kept writing, she would be alive. I did in writing what my mother did in praying.
Paula had a lot of high technology when she was sick. There was neurologists and breathing machines and so on. But you also brought in spiritual healers to help her.
At the beginning, I didn't bring them in. They just came. I don't know how they learned about this, and they just appeared one day, and they started doing sort of psychic or spiritual healing. that I don't know if that helped or not. I don't think it did, actually. But when I brought Paula to the United States, I thought that technology could help her in rehabilitation. After a month in a rehabilitation hospital, they told me that there was nothing that they could do because she had severe brain damage. She didn't have a brain, really. And at that point, I took her home. And then for 3 months, I tried everything, Terry. All psychics, shamans that you can even imagine, herbs, acupuncture, everything.
Did you go through a full range of feelings about whether those that approach is helping her or not?
Yeah, hope first. And then slowly you lose the hope because you don't see any change. Fortunately, I had a wonderful doctor, Dr. Sherry Forrester, a wonderful woman who helped me through that. She somehow allowed me to try everything. And then she said, okay, there's a point when we have to stop because this has to stop at a certain point. You can't go on forever with this. So we decided it would be for 3 months. And after 3 months, she reminded me that we had tried everything and nothing had worked. And at that point, I think I just relaxed and said, okay, I'm going to make Paula comfortable and just love her. And don't worry if she progresses or not.
And during this period, she was home at your house?
During the second part, because the first 5.5 months were in Madrid, and then I took her to California, and I had it at home.
When did you decide that you wanted to take her back home with you to San Francisco?
I decided that the first day that she fell in coma, I was waiting for her to be well enough so that I could fly her home. I had already convinced my son-in-law, who is a wonderful human being, that Paula had returned to the womb, and I was going to take care of her, and I was going to make her well.
Well, how did he feel about you taking her away from Madrid and bringing her back to San Francisco? Because they were living in Madrid.
He agreed because he knew that he could not do it. He had to work, so Paula would have to be institutionalized somewhere. And we didn't want that. We wanted to be with her and help her through life and death.
Did you ever think to yourself, how long could you take her living in this coma, knowing that she wasn't going to come out of it?
I never thought about that. If she could take it, I could too.
Were you ever worried about the memories of her being in a coma driving out memories of what she was like before that?
That year was very long. And in a way, for a long time after she died, I could only remember her sick and dead. Because after she died, we couldn't find her husband, who was traveling at the time. And we could only reach him the next day around noon. So for a day and a half at least, Paula stayed at home in her bed, and I stayed with her. It was too long. The image of her body there, already dead and very pale, and that was fixed in my memory. And for a long time, I just couldn't visualize her alive. And that year of illness became more important than the 28 years of her wonderful life. But then my stepfather came. And he had put together pieces of film that he had filmed Paula during her life. And he put all this together in half an hour of a wonderful videotape in which Paula is dancing. I'm cutting her hair. We are running in the beach. And then I could see her again as she was.
That's really important, isn't it?
Yeah. It's very important for us as a family to remember her the way she really was.
My guest is writer Isabel Allende. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1995 interview with Isabel Allende. Her memoir, Paula, about the death of her daughter, is now on the paperback bestseller list. Were you with your daughter when she died?
Yes, I was in bed with her, holding her.
Did you try to do things to help?
No.
Ease the death, yeah.
No, because it was very easy. She just started to breathe slowly, and then it took a long time, all day and all night, but she died peacefully. And I was holding her, and somehow it was a strange night. I have the feeling that maybe I was hallucinating, but I saw the room full of people, the dead and the living, hand in hand. My mother, my stepfather, Paula's father, people who were far away, were in the room that night somehow. At the same time, Willie was there, my son and my daughter-in-law, and they had placed the two babies at Paula's feet on the bed. So she was cuddled and held by all of us, by the spirits and the living.
She had given a letter to her husband before she got very sick, a letter that said, "Open this after I die." Did you ever wonder what led her to write that?
We have often wondered what happened. This is how the story goes, how Ernesto, Paula's husband, told me the story. They were in their honeymoon 9 months before she fell ill. At the time, there were absolutely no symptoms of the disease. And she was happy, in love, in her honeymoon, 27 years old. And she had a dream in the middle of the night. She woke up, wrote a letter, put it in an envelope, sealed the envelope with wax, and wrote outside, "To be open when I die," and gave it to her husband. Now, why would she write that letter? I don't know. But it must have been a terrifying dream, a sort of premonition in a dream. I don't have a letter like that. My mother, who is 74, doesn't have a letter like that. Anyhow, after she was sick for a long time, nearly a whole year, I decided to open the letter. That was by the end of November, when I really felt that she was drifting away. So I opened the letter, and the first sentence in the letter is, "I don't want to be trapped in my body." So what did she see in the dream? I don't know. The rest of the letter is a sort of spiritual will in which she says that she wants to be cremated and she doesn't want her name in any tomb and she wants her ashes scattered in nature, and that is what we did.
Was it hard for you to re-enter the world of the living after your daughter died? Did you almost feel like it wasn't right? Do you know what I mean?
No, on the contrary. I have three grandchildren. And I felt that I was betraying them. They need a joyful grandmother present in their lives. I think it's essential for children to have a grandmother or a grandfather or some older person that can dedicate a lot of time to them. And I was failing them. So I felt that I needed to get through this grieving as fast as possible and go back to life for them and for my husband too. We met very late, you know. And we have been together only for 7 years. Always we have the feeling that we missed so many years that we were not together. So I really wanted to go back to him too.
Writing about your daughter in the memoir, you've made public things that were very personal, I guess, particularly like the letter that she wrote about, what she wanted done with her body after death. Did you have any qualms about printing the letter and about sharing certain things about Paula's life?
No, not really. At the beginning, I wrote this book without the intention of publishing it. It was meant for her. And when later, as the family and I decided to publish it, it was maybe time to edit and take away some things. But every time I tried to do that, I had the feeling that I was betraying the book. So I just left it as I had written it in the first place. And I don't think that it's offensive in any way for Paula. She was a very private person, but she was also a teacher. And I think that this long and painful agony, this experience of life and death, is something that is so rich in its content that many people can find in the book a space where they can get in touch with their own losses and separations and with the celebration and joy of life. And Paula would have liked that.
Do you feel like you've emerged from this any more fearless about death?
I don't have any fear of death anymore. I didn't have a lot before because I didn't contemplate death at all. Like most people, I thought that it was not going to happen yet. And I never imagined that one of my children would die. So I had not a personal worry about death. After this experience, I lost the fear of death because I understand that it is not the opposite of life. It's a continuation of life. And I know that nothing that I can do to protect or to control the circumstances will change the destiny of my children or my grandchildren or myself or my mother or whoever I love that may die before I do. I am not afraid of death. And when you lose the fear of death, there are very other few fears that you have. So in a way, I have become stronger. I feel liberated.
Before we end our conversation, I guess I'd like to just ask you if there's anything you'd like to add.
Well, maybe one thing that we should say is that, during that incredible year, it was a very intense time. Many things happened that were extremely dramatic. And one of them was that my granddaughter, Andrea, was born in the same room where Paula died 6 months later. So I had the opportunity to see both events, death and birth, in a contained space in a very short time. And I learned a lot with those two experiences. I had the impression that both were made of the same fabric, that Andrea was coming to the world with pain and difficulty, not carrying any memories from where she had been before. And I had the impression that the mother was like a door, and I was pulling this baby through this door from another world into this world. In the same way, 6 months later, I was in bed holding my daughter, walking with her to a threshold and trying to cross that threshold with her to see what was life there as it had been before for Andrea. You know, that the feeling that life is a station in a long journey of the soul. That was so clear to me with those two events that happened that year.
Isabel Allende, her memoir Paula, about the death of her daughter, is on the paperback bestseller list. Our interview was recorded 1 year ago. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a Lester Young reissue. We're listening to it now. And we remember writer Jessica Mitford, who died this week at the age of 78. We'll play back an interview in which she discussed researching her best-known work, The American Way of Death, an expose of the funeral industry. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says there are a lot of romantic legends about jazz musicians, an awful lot of which portray them as tragic victims. In reality, Kevin says, some of these putative victims are more resilient than some folks give them credit for. In that context, Kevin reviews a new reissue of 40s recordings by tenor saxophonist Lester Young.
Few myths in jazz that endure no matter how often the true facts are laid out. That Coleman Hawkins recorded his classic Body and Soul as an afterthought at the end of a session. That Bessie Smith bled to death after a Mississippi road accident because she was denied admission to a white hospital. That Lester Young quit Count Basie's band because he refused to record on Friday the 13th. And that Young emerged from the army after World War II, a broken man whose playing had lost its old exuberance. In reality, Hawkins had been rehearsing Body and Soul for years. Bessie Smith was taken directly to a black hospital, where she died 10 hours after being admitted, and Lester Young wasn't superstitious. Young did have a terrible time in the Army. He liked soft shoes and smoking marijuana. But as for the Army breaking his spirit, here he is in 1946, a year after his discharge. The myth of the broken post-war Lester Young may be on the way out, because the rebuttal evidence is overwhelming. Case in point, the source of the music we just heard, the complete Aladdin recordings of Lester Young, a 2-CD set from Blue Note. He recorded for the Aladdin label between 1942 and 47. Now, it is true that Lester Young's style changed after the 1930s. Back when he was the star of the Count Basie band, his tone was much more airy. This is Young in 1939. Now listen to Lester Young on his first Aladdin session in 1942. Before he went in the Army. As you'll hear, his sound had changed already. His tone and vibrato were heavier. The tune is Indiana, and the piano player is Nat Cole. Thank you. So the question arises, why did Lester Young change his sound? On one level, the answer is technical. He'd switched to a new and better saxophone mouthpiece. But that leaves the larger philosophical issue hanging. No one knows for sure, but I have my own theory, which may explain why Coleman Hawkins and Sonny Rollins and Clifford Jordan and other saxophonists altered their sounds as they got older. They did it for the same reason you change your breakfast cereal or the route you take to the mailbox. To exercise free will, to keep from getting bored, just to remind yourself you're still alive. Or as Lester Young himself once put it, I try not to be a repeater pencil. You dig?
Given Whitehead is a jazz critic currently living in Amsterdam, he reviewed the complete Aladdin recordings of Lester Young from Blue Note. Coming up, we remember writer Jessica Mitford with a 1989 interview. This is Fresh Air. Writer Jessica Mitford died Tuesday at the age of 78 of cancer. Jessica Mitford was famous for several reasons. There was her investigative books. Her best-known book, The American Way of Death, revealed how the funeral industry was fleecing grief-stricken Americans. When the book was published, an editorial in the conservative magazine National Review said, "The fact that Mitford's written a good book doesn't mean she's a civilized human being." Which gets to another reason why Mitford was famous. She was committed to radical causes throughout her life. In the 50s, as a former member of the Communist Party, she refused to give any information to the House Un-American Activities Committee. She later wrote about the party in her memoir, A Fine Old Conflict. Mitford grew up in the English countryside, the daughter of a lord, which gets to yet another source of her notoriety. She was one of England's most unusual groups of sisters. There were six Mitford sisters, including Unity, who was briefly romantically involved with Hitler, Diana, who married Oswald Mosley, the head of Britain's Union of Fascists, and Nancy, who became one of Britain's popular novelists. I spoke to Jessica Mitford in San Francisco. She'd lived in the Bay Area since 1947. Our interview was recorded in 1989. Jessica Mitford, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
There's so much I want to talk with you about your life. Let's start kind of way back.
How far?
In your childhood, when you were a young girl from a prosperous family, growing up in the English countryside, reading pacifist and leftist literature and getting very excited about it, what was the initial appeal to you of it?
Well, you know, I've thought this over since. I believe, actually, that one is very much the product of one's own time. I mean, the 60s people were a product of their time, weren't they? Now, I was a 30s person. In other words, I was born in 1917, so by 1930 I was about 13 years old, reading everything I could lay hands on, like most children, and sort of fascinated with the growing politics all around me. It was the Depression in England, tremendous poverty, huge areas called, unemployable areas. And then there was fascism rising abroad. So these things made me think.
You're talking about how you think of yourself as being a product of your time. But it's fascinating how, as a product of your time, you became a leftist, yet two of your sisters became fascists. And it's really so hard to imagine sisters in the same family growing up so different. Do you have any explanation for it?
I never have been able to figure it out myself, frankly. I've been asked that lots of times.
I'm sure you have.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, though, that some say it's sibling rivalry, which I don't believe, really. I really don't think so. I don't think we were jealous of each other. It was just that I happened to see things differently from the beginning.
It seems to me that politics must have become much more complex to you because you knew people on the other side. It's easy to dehumanize people on the other side and just see them as the enemy and almost inhuman. But when it's your sisters who are there, you have to see it in its full complexity.
Well, perhaps that's true. I'm a terrific partisan. I do take sides, and I did then, too. And the fact that they were sisters didn't really alter things. I remember Unity and I saying to each other that, if one of us should have to give the order for the other one's execution, would we do it? Answer, yes. Pretty cold-blooded.
A strange girlhood game to have to play. You kept a running away account when you were young, money so that you could run away from home. But what you ended up using your running away account for was to try to go to Spain with the man who you later married.
That's it, yeah. And that was just right around £50.
And this was during the Spanish Civil War, and you already knew which side you were on. You kind of went from this quiet, rural, country life, the daughter of a lord, to suddenly being a political radical involved in a revolution, a young married woman married to someone who was also from a wealthy background. Your husband was the nephew of Winston Churchill.
Right, yes.
I wonder if you started to see your own families as the opposition.
Whether I ever saw them?
If you saw them as the opposition.
If I saw them as the opposition.
In the political battles you were waging.
Absolutely, yeah. See, both my parents went completely on the side of Hitler, which was very surprising. We were brought up in the shadow of the First World War, in a way. And in those days, you see, the Huns, they were the filthy Huns who had killed Uncle Clem and numerous other relations in the First World War. People, of course, that I never knew because I was just born during that time. And then all of a sudden, that Hitler became a tremendous star. He did away with the labor unions, with the Communist Party. He was doing away with the Jews. And you can't discount the amount of anti-Semitism that goes on in the English upper class.
You wrote about your membership in the Communist Party in your book, A Fine Old Conflict. What got you to join when you did?
Well, see, in the first place, I'd always been a terrific supporter of the Communist Party in England ever since I was about 15. Because if you sort of studied the times in those days, the communists were in the forefront of the fight for the rights of unemployed, an end to things like the means test, which was a rotten sort of Tory ploy to prevent the unemployed from collecting unemployed insurance or welfare. And then they were also in the forefront of the fight against fascism, both in Germany and Italy, but in Spain above all. It was the communists who recruited all the young people who flocked from all over the world into the International Brigade, of which Esmond Romilly was one, and that's how I met him. And then we sort of ran off to Spain together, So that was sort of the progression of that. But we never actually joined the party, Esmond and I, in those days. After Esmond was killed, I stayed in Washington with my baby dinky, Constantia Romilly. So then I remarried in 1943 Bob Truhaft, a lawyer who I'd met in the OPA where I was working. And that was in San Francisco. We moved out to San Francisco. And there, again, the Communist Party in those years seemed to me the absolute sort of lodestar or the kind of backbone, really, if you like, of all progressive left-wing movements, the steadfast supporters of rights of black people, that kind of thing. And this is what made us determined to join. So we did join in 1943 and remained members, in fact, until 58, which was quite a longish time.
So many people were harassed during the McCarthy period, and so many lives were ruined. I'm thinking that it must have been hard to harass someone like you, someone who had been outspoken all of her life and who had already like a reputation for eccentricity because of her family. I mean, did you feel like, what can you do to hurt me?
Well, I did a little bit. I'll tell you what I really felt, which is that the hell with them sort of thing. I mean, we were subpoenaed, Bob Truhaft, my husband, and I were both subpoenaed. And I was subpoenaed but by not only the main House Committee on Un-American Activities, but also the local version of the same, the California Committee, and so on. And, what could you do? When I was subpoenaed by the main House Committee, I was among 100 people. There were sort of huge headlines in the Chronicle and other papers. 100 Bay Reds subpoenaed. Well, of course, if I hadn't been one of those, I'd have been rather miffed. Do you know the feeling? Sort of rather annoyed. But anyhow, I was one. But they never finally called me. But what I found out was that they were bound to pay per diem, or was it? No, it wasn't per diem. It was travel allowance. So much a mile. And since we lived in Oakland, I put in for $40 for travel allowance for the week that I was forced to be there, and then turned over the check to the Communist Party. I hoped to annoy them somehow, you know.
Were there other things that you did just to kind of irritate the McCarthyites, to try to get even with them, again, since you didn't feel like you had that much to lose?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, what could you lose, you know?
But, I mean, were there other things that you did to...
To annoy,
yeah.
I can't really remember them. I think the main thing that sticks in mind of those days was the children. Dinky was about seven to 9 years old, that kind of age. And you see, a lot of communists didn't tell their children anything about their politics. But I always told mine, because why not? I didn't exactly say Communist Party, because that might have put them on the spot if they were ever being tortured, you know, to tell. But I told them when we read in the papers that alleged marvelous liberal Hubert Humphrey, at the time, proposed on the floor of Congress, and it's all in the congressional record, to set up camps, detention camps, for dangerous people, for 100,000 dangerous people. Well, of course, if they'd rounded up 100,000 and we weren't among them, I'd have been furious. But never mind, they didn't do it. But I told Dinky, you know, they're setting up camps for people like us. And she immediately, oh, I want to go to camp. It's she thought it was going to be lovely, sort of riding and swimming, you know, all that stuff.
Tennis.
Yeah.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with Jessica Mitford, who died earlier this week. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1989 interview with Jessica Mitford. She died earlier this week. Jessica Mitford, let's talk a little bit about your writing. You're best known for the book, The American Way of Death, your expose of the funeral industry. What led you to want to expose the horrors of the funeral industry and how they would get people when they were weak and take them for whatever they could?
Well, it is rather weird, I admit. You know, it's an odd subject indeed. I think the thing is that Bob Trueheft, my husband, mm-hmm. who's a lawyer in Oakland, was representing numerous trade unions. And along about the middle 1950s, he began to notice, to his fury, that every time a union member died, the breadwinner of a family, the hard-fought-for union benefits meant to go to the widow and children would wind up being the price of the funeral. So he started organizing the Bay Area Funeral Society, a non-profit thing, which I thought was rather boring, frankly. I mean, I said, well, look, we're robbed every day in the supermarkets and by the landlords and things, so why pick on the wretched undertakers? Until I began reading the trade magazines.
Oh, what did you see in there?
Oh, God. Well, the titles would lead you on. Mortuary Management, Casket and Sunnyside. One, Casket and Sunnyside. And my favorite title of all, you know, which really makes you think, Concept, the Journal of Creative Ideas for Cemeteries. Well, I mean, you know, if you saw those, wouldn't you be reading them like mad? I did. And I found therein a whole wonder world of the mortuary that I'd never known existed. You know, I hadn't known, for instance, that you could have a choice of foam rubber or inner spring mattress for your eternal sealer casket and that kind of thing. And I started sending away for samples, and it was all so delightful. So then I started writing that book.
Did you go undercover and pose as someone who had a deceased loved one so that you could shop for funeral arrangements and see what it was like?
I did quite a bit of that. That was one of the best parts of it, especially Forest Lawn in Los Angeles. That was tremendous fun.
What was the experience there like?
Well, I mean, I went there. Actually, I went with a young man who is an American fellow who was teaching English history or something in one of the colleges there in Los Angeles. And so we made up that he was my nephew and I was his English aunt. And my sister was dying or something, you see. And we wanted to make pre-need arrangements. So I said we want to see everything. But in those days, by the way, Forest Lawn was there was a price war on. And Forest Lawn was advertising on billboards funerals from $145, you see, which sounded very reasonable. So I said to the grief therapist, they're not salesmen, you know, they're grief therapists. I said to the grief therapist, well, we want to see everything in the nature of all the coffins that I can choose the best, most appropriate. So the first one we came to was $16,500. Now, you have to realize we're talking in the early 1960s. So you can double that or triple it or whatever for the inflation, what it is. And I must say it was rather magnificent, you know. And I looked at it longingly. And then I said, well, could we see the $145 one? And so, you know, he took ages finding it. It was sort of hidden away somewhere. And, my dear, it was purple. It had a purple, really hideous. And I said, I looked at it and I said, my sister wouldn't be caught dead in that sort of thing, you know. And so then we kind of went along and saw all the different plots and blah, blah. And it was great fun.
After writing The American Way of Death, did you find yourself in the position of having to genuinely prepare somebody's funeral and having to shop for real in the funeral industry?
Yeah, I have once or twice. But my favorite thing in that line, there was a man called Howard Gossage, extremely well known in San Francisco, but he died many years ago. He was a wonderful, he was an ad man, advertising writer. And when he was, he did all those marvelous things in The New Yorker about the getaway car. I mean, it's all years old. I don't know if people remember it. But he was much more than that. He was a brilliant and funny fellow in all ways. So he was dying of leukemia. We knew he was dying and not expected to live. So one morning about 4, 5 a.m., his brother-in-law rang up, and who I hadn't met. And he said, Howard died in the middle of the night. And his last words to me was, when I go, and I think it'll be very soon now, be sure to get hold of Jessica because she knows how to nose out the cheapest coffin in this whole town. So you know how when somebody dies and the survivors, you know, you always sort of say, or people say, well, what can I do anything? And the answer is no, obviously. But in this case, yes was the answer. So I went and collected the widow, who was a beautiful young actress. And together we went, my God, I got one for $150 all in. You know, and he was a rich man, and he would have been considered a super prize for the undertakers.
Have you made real plans for how you would want to be buried? A lot of people, like when they're very young, buy plots.
Yeah.
Or there's like, you know, a family plot, and they know that that's where they'll be. Or they make plans for cremation, and they let everybody in their family know what they'd want. You know, if...
Of course, what I'd like is to go full fig. You know, the embalmers can take 20 years off your looks, and everybody come have a sort of huge bash, you know. But I'm afraid that's not going to happen. I'm afraid it's going to be what the undertakers call burn and scatter for me.
Cremation.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was upset reading in your book that even in cremation there's ways that they get you.
Oh, of course, yeah. Look, there's nothing more, you know, seductive than a prophet. And they're no more... Really, they're probably no more far out than any other sort of small businessman, but they sure do make a profit from everything.
Is your choice of cremation purely kind of price-oriented, or is it also like a practical thing of not thinking that we should take up space underground?
Well, it's a bit of both, you know, yeah. Actually, if you just bury the person without a coffin, They do lots of good to the garden.
Jessica Mitford, I want to ask you about your new book called Grace Had an English Heart. And this is basically the story of the woman around whom a now famous a British ballad was written. Tell us briefly what the story the ballad tells is.
Well, it was about the fact that this 22-year-old girl who lived in a lighthouse off the coast of England, off the northern coast, had helped to rescue 9 shipwrecked people in the year 1838. Oh, well, why don't I sing it?
Please.
Will you join in when I say help, help? I'll give a signal.
Oh no. This is my nightmare, having to do a radio sing-along.
It goes, 'Twas on the Longstone lighthouse that dwelt an English maid, pure as the air around her, of danger ne'er afraid. One morning, just at daybreak, a storm-tossed wreck she spied, and up spake brave Grace, darling, I'll save the crew, she cried. So she pulled away o'er the rolling sea, over the waters blue. All together, help, help, she could hear the cry of the ship, wrecked crew. But Grace had an English heart, and the raging storm she braved. She pulled away all the dashing spray, and the crew she saved. Anyhow, that was the song we all used to sing. And she always stuck in my mind a good bit, Grace Darling. You know, I mean, she was a very brave girl. She was 22 years old when the rescue happened, and this was in the year 1838, 1 year after Queen Victoria came to the throne. And Grace Darling sort of personified all the Victorian, rather boring virtues, I'm sorry to say, that also Mrs. Thatcher would endorse, wouldn't she? You know, sort of piety, chastity, obedience to authority, all these things. Anyway, I got interested in doing the book, and to me the most interesting part was how the press hoopla began in such an early time in history. In other words, in the very early 1930s.
Did this song have an influence on your childhood? Were you supposed to live up to the model of Grace Darling?
I don't think so. We used to sing all kinds of stupid songs, including all the sort of 30s songs, you know, like I've Got You Under My Skin. We weren't supposed to live up to that.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Jessica Mitford, it's been such a pleasure to have you here. I thank you very, very much for joining
us. Well, thank you. I've loved every minute.
Jessica Mitford died Tuesday of cancer at the age of 78. Her body will be cremated and her remains will be scattered at sea. Our interview was recorded in 1989. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Al Banks, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. We also had assistance from Phoebe Vanskoy. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
As more rock musicians die of drug-related deaths, Tim Collins is helping lead an anti-drug campaign within the music industry. Collins has managed the band Aerosmith since 1984. He's credited with helping the band kick drugs and mount an incredible comeback. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.